thought that the World Trade Center towers could come down, but they did. And I think that we have to, in this new era, start thinking about worst-case scenarios. That requires us to deal squarely and honestly with Indian Point. I just want to remind you that one of the two planes that crashed into the World Trade Center towers flew right down the Hudson, used the Hudson as its, you know, mast to guide it down to New York City. A slight left turn, left bank of one of those planes could have caused the planes to crash into the twin domes, or one of the twin domes of Indian Point. If that had happened, the consequences would have been far more dire than the ones that we already saw experienced. Second, multiple vulnerabilities. The industry is very quick to say these are hardened containment domes, they can withstand a crash. First of all, the NRC has not said that that's the case, and Mark will get into some of the details and the statistics, but that has not been demonstrated. No one really knows, and the fact is the NRC suspects that one out of two commercial jets could penetrate 5 feet of concrete. Well, at the top of those domes is only 3.5 feet of concrete, so you can do the math. It's very possible to penetrate those domes. Even setting the domes aside, though, you've got the spent fuel, 600 tons of spent fuel, radiated fuel, that's on site, that sits and is protected by Butler buildings, essentially corrugated metal with a little bit of cement. They're not designed to protect even against a truck bomb, let alone a plane crash. And the amount of material that's in these spent fuel pools dwarfs what was at Chernobyl, and we all know what happened at Chernobyl. You also are talking about the control rooms, they're not well protected, and it's such a complex and elaborate system to protect the reactors and the spent fuel pools and to keep them cool and so forth, that there are myriad ways to disable this safety system. Plus, you've got a lot of folks, as Mark will tell you, and I won't steal his thunder, you've got security agents who have suspicious credentials, and you've also got just recently, 4 months or 3 months after the September 11th, you had 4 of the 7 operations crews fail their tests, i.e., if there were to be a serious accident there, they failed the tests that would demonstrate whether they could prevent an accident from spiraling out of control. Okay, I got to move faster. How am I doing on time? About 5 minutes left? Okay. Let's see how quick I can go. Security, they're not required under regulations to secure the plants. And in addition, we who live right up in that area have seen very little evidence. Coast Guard protection is scant. They have no anti-aircraft missiles. The ground troops they've got are suspect in terms of their training and their numbers. There's no no-fly zone in place. They've got minimal protection against this plant, to protect this plant. Operations, I've already mentioned that. Just quickly, again, Unit 2, there's 2 reactors up there. The second reactor, or the first reactor really, the oldest reactor that's still running, has the worst safety record of any reactor in the entire country. And that's without the threat of terrorism. Third, the consequences. If you were to have a major accident at that plant, you're talking about thousands, if not tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of deaths, and certainly those kinds of numbers in terms of injuries. In terms of economic consequences, the NRC's own study predicts that if you had an accident at even one of the reactors, you would have $600 billion worth of economic damage to property in Westchester County alone. If you then multiply that, if you then factor in the damage that could potentially that could happen to New York City and the 20 other counties that lie within a 50-mile radius, you're talking about trillions, if not trillions of dollars worth of economic damage. Just to put that in perspective, the damage from the World Trade Center was $84 billion. We're talking about trillions or tens of trillions of dollars worth of damage. Basically, much of the northeastern region could be wiped out, and it could very much debilitate for a long, long time our economy. Let's see, water supply. Again, I raised that earlier. We all count on the reservoirs and streams from upstate for our water here. If you have an accident at Indian Point, some of these reservoirs through which 90% of your water flows could be, I'm not sure about permanently, but certainly for years and years and years, destroyed. That means that even if you could survive, you wouldn't have any water to drink, or certainly no water, safe water to drink. So you'd be up a creek, to say the least. Let's see, and then finally the energy issue. I think that's a very important one to mention. A lot of people do have concerns about that. Alice mentioned earlier the subsidies that have been provided to this industry. They said early on, nuclear power is so cheap, it's too cheap to meter. Nothing could be farther from the truth. There is no source of power that is more expensive once you factor in the real cost. What the nuclear industry did back in 1957 under the Price-Anderson Act is they permanently externalized those costs. Price-Anderson basically indemnifies them from liability so that they have a minimal payout if there's to be an accident. Again, I was talking just for one plant. We're talking about trillions, if not tens of trillions, of damage just from one reactor. The entire industry in this country is covered for $9.4 billion. It's a fraction of what would happen if you had an accident at just one of those 103 reactors. So that is a farce. The other issue is storage. They struck a deal with Congress and said, listen, we can't build these plants because if we build them, we're going to have to dispose of the waste. And that is far too expensive for us to do. We can never make money at this. Congress said, don't worry about it. We'll take responsibility. Just store it on site, and then at some point we'll find a central repository, i.e. Yucca Mountain, and then we'll store it for you and we'll relieve you of the cost. Well, Yucca Mountain didn't happen. It's about 20 years since that fight's been going on, and I guarantee you, despite what Secretary Abraham says, it is not going to happen. I guarantee you it's not going to happen in the next 10 or 20 years, certainly not in time for us to deal with this situation in the way we need to. Again, reliability is an important issue. Indian Point does provide up to 16% of the New York City and Westchester supply of electricity. That is not an insubstantial amount, but that reflects summertime rates. In the summer, when you have peak demand because of the heat and because of air conditioner use, Indian Point does provide an important source of power. Is it irreplaceable? Absolutely not. We have already approved something like four or five new plants in the Hudson Valley in New York City that are to come online in 2004. So we know from 2004 on we can easily satisfy our demand for electricity. Even in the interim, there's questions as to whether we'll get brownouts. Will we reduce our reserve margins a little bit? Absolutely. We will be slightly more vulnerable to brownouts. But are there other ways to address that? Absolutely. And again, Mark and some of these other experts will get into the details. There are lots of things we can do to make up for that power, even if we shut it down tomorrow.
You're just talking about 2 months in the summer.
Yeah, and let me just remind you, and thank you very much. I'll get to the third quick point about pricing. Again, I was just talking about reliability, i.e. are we going to have brownouts? The second issue is, are your bills going to go up? Your bills would probably go up in the summer months, at least until we get that new power online. But we're talking about, if you pay $100 a month in July and August for your electricity bill, you're talking about it going up by $6 to $10 each month. You're talking about $20 to $30 over the course of the year. If you look at that in terms of an insurance policy that you don't have right now, by shutting this plant down, I think it's well worth the money. And I think for most of us, that's not a lot. For those of us who it is a hardship for, we have to look to the state to help subsidize lower income folks who maybe would suffer from that. Okay, I finally just want to say, and again, these guys will get into the details, Riverkeeper is part of the fastest growing political movement, from what I can tell, and from what I've heard from people who have been here a lot longer than I have. I am a native New Yorker, but I've not been working on this issue for more than a couple months. But apparently it's the fastest growing movement, at least in Westchester and probably in New York State, since the 60s and perhaps beyond. We already have, and let me just lay out our two strategies, and these are multi-layered, multifaceted. But essentially, in a nutshell, our two strategies are try and create the kind of political and public groundswell support to put enough pressure on elected officials, namely Governor Pataki or whoever is governor in the fall, and it may or may not be Governor Pataki, depending on the outcome of this issue, put enough pressure on our governor to take the word to Congress and to the Bush administration that we do not accept this plant being in our neighborhood and in our communities, and we want to shut down. I don't care what the NRC has done, I don't care what their history is, this plant has to be shut down, and we're going to make sure it gets shut down. Second issue is, from a kind of an economic and legal one, is that we have to start to make companies like Entergy, the company that owns this plant, start to internalize their costs, start to internalize some of the costs that they've imposed on us. And there's various legal mechanisms to do that, and we're going to be pursuing every single one of those, I guarantee you. Finally, I just want to make a pitch to all of you. I think it's incredibly exciting that you're all here tonight. I have to be honest with you. I expected about a quarter of this crowd, and I don't know whether Julia is just a genius at organizing, mm-hmm. or whether people in New York do get this and
everybody
do understand.
Wants to change the world.
Okay, good. Well, this is a good place to start, and this is a key issue to start on. There is no issue, certainly in New York State, and I would argue in this country, but we're not getting into that because we're a local organization focused on local issues, that is more pressing for New Yorkers and the citizens of New York State. And I'm very, very happy that you're all out here tonight. But I encourage you, it can't stop here. You have to educate yourselves. You have to go and don't just rely on us. Go and look at the NRC materials. Go and educate yourself. Go and talk to other people. But once you do, and once you're convinced of this position, we need your help. You've got to get out there like Julia, like Elizabeth, and like the rest of us, and start educating your fellow citizens. And we've got to put pressure on our elected officials. That means Bloomberg and the City Council. We are starting to work on putting that kind of pressure on the City Council. We need to start working on Bloomberg, but we are going to need your help. So it's vital. I'd finally just say, I think we have a great opportunity here because, and I apologize, I know I'm going too long, but I'm not going to be able to answer any of the questions in the Q&A. So I think this is a really exciting opportunity. 9/11 floored all of us. We're still reeling from that experience. But I think that this gives us an opportunity to take control of our security and the safety of our families. And that is very empowering. It's very exciting to sit in a room with committed citizens. And I think even if we never close the plant down, and I assure you we will, but even if we didn't, there is something very powerful about getting in a room and starting to share ideas and share commitments towards a future that we all share. And it's not a future that's endorsed by this administration and many other elected officials in this country. Campaign finance reform is a key issue that we need to be focused on. Now I'm getting my soapbox and I'll end there. But I salute you all for being here and greatly look forward to working with you.
I'm going to try to fill in some of the pieces, some of the details of the pieces that Alex has already brought up here. And it's details that it's important that we have. I mean, when we go out and we talk to people about this issue, we have to be absolutely possible. And it's important to stress information and sources of information to people. Because as with so many issues, there are two positions. There's the mainstream position and there's the fringe position. But this issue is different. And the reason it's different is that the fringe position is that which is held by the owner-operators of nuclear power plants, and the mainstream position is held by the citizens, the concerned people who live around nuclear power plants. Now, I know that's a strong statement, but I say that because I have documentation for everything. Documentation is primarily from the federal agency, which does not do a sufficient job of protecting us. But if you dig through their reports and you look at what information they have gathered, they have plenty of evidence to show us about the dangers of nuclear power, about the dangers of Indian Point in particular. It's all out there in their own reports. And all we have to do is cut and paste and put that information right out back there. And we have our argument. Now let's start with Indian Point. Prior to 9/11, was Indian Point this smoothly running nuclear power plant that we could rely on? This is a safe, well-oiled operating machine? Absolutely not. This Indian Point 2 is the worst rated nuclear power plant in the United States of America. It is the only nuclear power plant with a red finding against it by the NRC ever. What that means is it has multiple degraded cornerstones in more than one area of the operation of this nuclear power plant. Its operation is degraded. But now Entergy has come in, a new company, owns and operates it. They're experts at this, so it's better now, right? No, it's not better now. December of 2000, 2 months ago, the NRC did a report card on this plant. They had the opportunity to remove that red finding. Did they? No, on this nuclear power plant. And how did it come to exist? It came to exist because over 10,000 gallons of radioactive steam was released into the atmosphere, the area surrounding the plant, on February 15, 2000, as a result of faulty steam generators that the owner-operator knew was faulty. You know how we know they knew that? It's scary when you listen to this story. They knew it because they sued the people who manufactured the steam generators. Not only that, they got replacement steam generators as part of the deal they worked out. And they were put on site. But you know what? And this is important. When we talk about issues, we have to always be thinking about money. Right? Where's the money? Because that's where the influence is. How much does it cost not to operate this plant? This is the incentive or the disincentive that the owner-operator is always working with. $600,000 a day for them not to operate the plant. So why for years would they leave replacement, brand new steam generators on site and not put them in? Because it costs $600,000 a day for them to close it down and do work, and it would have taken a month to 2 months to put in the new steam generator. So they knew they were faulty. The NRC knew they were faulty. They're only power plant in the country working with these steam generators. And then they had a problem with them. And even after that release of February 15, 2000, they didn't want to replace them. And it took a citizens' movement working in conjunction with elected officials to get them to replace those steam generators. So now they're the worst run, most dangerous nuclear power plant in the country with more new steam generators. But now things are different. Things are different as a result of 9/11. We have to look at what is the potential for harm here. And the owner-operator of this plant is real clear. They look at what we say and then they take things out of context and they lie about what we're saying. Because they're very proud of this. You know what? The nuclear power plant is not going to blow up. No matter what we do to it. Well, I mean, maybe I'll come up with something. But almost nothing we could do could make it blow up. It's not going to explode in a mushroom cloud. Now, does that make us feel safe? It shouldn't. Because that isn't the risk of a nuclear power plant. The risk isn't that it's going to blow up. But they're very proud that it's not. What's the risk? The risk is that the plant will melt down. And that when it melts down, the radioactive materials, the radioactive fuel inside the reactor core gets out of control. That when that happens, there will be a breach of containment. That is, that one of the domes will have a hole in it. Or the irradiated fuel pools, where almost 30 years worth of irradiated fuel is stored, will have a hole in it when it melts down. And then what will happen? You will have a cloud, which will be released, a radioactive plume, which will be spread by the wind all over the surrounding area. What's the risk? Well, 1982, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission did a study, CRAC 2 study, in order to determine in one of the severe case scenarios, not even the worst case, but one of the severe cases, what's the potential for harm? 46 to 50,000 deaths in the first year. That's what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission told us. That doesn't include cancer deaths. That doesn't include deaths after the first year. What does that mean in terms of long-term results? What about this area? Well, look at Chernobyl. And now this is another one of those great myths that keeps being thrown around by the owner-operator. This plant is nothing like Chernobyl. Well, it's a different type of reactor. It is indeed a pressurized water reactor, and it has larger, stronger containment domes and does not have problems in the same way as Chernobyl. That is true. But it has many, if not most, of the same radioactive materials inside the reactor. And if the plant melts down, the result would be very similar. So we need to look at Chernobyl as a test case. Now, if you go to Chernobyl, you'll find that there's a 20-mile radius around the plant that is currently uninhabitable, in addition to a 5-mile radius circle further outside of that as a result of the direction of the wind at that time. That's what's happened right there, right now. That's predominantly as a result of cesium-137, that radioactive material. So how much of that is there at Indian Point? Well, there's a comparable amount, maybe a little bit more, in the containment domes at Indian Point as there was at Chernobyl. But worse than that, the irradiated fuel pools has much, much more irradiated fuel. It has an order of magnitude more. 30 to 42 million curies of cesium-137 are in the irradiated fuel pools. What does that mean? Well, if you look at Chernobyl, it was a release of under 3 million curies. And we're talking about 30 to 42 million curies. That could cause an uninhabitable area of between 93 and 104 mile radius around Indian Point. What does that mean? I mean, you want to think realistically about this. It doesn't mean you walk into that zone and you're immediately going to die. What it means is, in terms of the uninhabitable zone, that if you move into that area, you are likely to die of cancer within 1 year at a significant, statistically significantly higher rate. High enough that our government, in doing some level of responsible regulation, would not allow anybody to live there. That would be the result. So the potential for harm is great. Are the plants susceptible? Absolutely. After 9/11, there was some added security put on. The problem is, it's almost all gone. This plant is not protected by land, by air, by water. What do we have by land? By land is actually the best protection. They have some security force there on their own, although a worker at the plant, whistleblowers often come forward and talk to some of us because they're afraid to talk to their supervisors, they're afraid to talk to the NRC, so they give us information anonymously. They talked to us pretty much right after 9/11, and they said, you know, most of the security force here is about able to protect you as well as security guards at Burger King. In addition to those Burger King-like security guards, which is what they call their paramilitary force, they have brought in National Guard troops. So those people who are maybe accountants during the day, during their work day, they on the weekend when they play Army, those are the type of people who are also there protecting us. And there aren't that many of them, because if you drive by the plant, I mean, we don't know the exact numbers, they're not going to release that, but if you drive by the plant, you see two or three people at the front entrance. Thank God I don't go in there with a van full of explosives, because you know what? Two or three people aren't gonna stop a van that wants to get close to that plant. And that's our best protection. What about protection by water? Well, there was one Coast Guard cutter specifically targeted to tool around in the area in the Hudson right around Indian Point after 9/11. But that got too expensive. And now they've taken it away and they're using the standard supervision of the Hudson that they used before. So the Coast Guard cutter is still generally around, but not giving any added attention to Indian Point. How about by air? Well, there's no anti-aircraft weaponry on site. After 9/11, they had some fighter planes and some helicopters flying overhead. They're gone. They have fighter planes in New Jersey. I don't know exactly how much good that's going to do us. There was a new fly zone, a no-fly zone that was instituted for a matter of 2 or 3 weeks, which never apply to the larger planes, which this plant is most susceptible to anyway, but that is gone. So we're not protected. It's not safe. I live 4 miles from the plant. When I hear a plane go overhead, and I hear a lot of them, I'm always happy when it gets far enough away that I know it's not crashing into the plant. That's what it's like to live in that community. When the fire alarm goes off in my community, the question on everyone's mind is that the fire alarm or is that Indian Point? Is it happening now? That's what we think. One second, where's my notes? There we go. So the evacuation plan. Every nuclear power plant is required to have a plan to evacuate the people who live around the plant. Now, first of all, this is insufficient. It's only a 10-mile area radius plan. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's own report, the same report I cited earlier on, says that if the radius was increased to a 25-mile radius around the plant, it would decrease the number of fatalities in the first year by a third. It would bring it down to a third. The example they give is it would go from 50,000 to 17,000 just by increasing the emergency evacuation zone. I don't think the NRC is going to act on this. This report came out in 1982 and they haven't done anything about it. This plant is located in the most densely populated area for any nuclear power plant in the United States of America. Over 20 million people live within 50 miles of Indian Point. That's 8% of the population of the entire United States of America. It's the wrong place for a nuclear power plant. If you support nuclear power, you would think that you would want this plant closed down because it's the wrong place for a nuclear power plant. But the evacuation plan, this is one of the most severe criticisms of it. Everything has changed about that after 9/11 because that plan was not set up to deal with terrorism as a scenario. It wasn't considered a likely enough possibility. It is meant to deal with accident scenarios. What's one of the main differences between an accident scenario and a terrorist scenario is one thing, time. In an accident scenario, in many of the cases, you have 5, 10, 15, 20 hours, even maybe 2 days warning of a problem going on at the plant. In a terrorist scenario, you can have a large amount of radiation released in 1 to 2 hours. And then that's spread by the winds at what, 5 to 12 miles an hour, depending how windy a day it is. You don't have that time anymore. Best case scenario, according to the evacuation plan, if everything goes perfectly in this plan, which is a ludicrous plan, which looks like this, and I've read it. If everything goes perfectly, they're going to be able to evacuate a 2-mile radius around the plant and some of a 5-mile radius around the plant in 5 to 7 hours, if everything goes perfectly. They didn't even put time estimates for 10 miles an hour, 10 miles around the plant. That's my 2-minute warning. So I'm going to then skip and talk just about two other things. Why should we close this plant down now? Because a lot of people think, well, if we close it down, we still have those irradiated fuel pools, and they're a danger. And closing it down may not make the plant that much safer. Well, first of all, that's a myth. Closing the plant down immediately, within 20 days, will reduce early fatalities by 80%. And will reduce cancer deaths in the first year by 50%. Now, why is that? Because some of the most highly radioactive material in the reactor dome has a very short half-life. So if we stop using irradiated fuel, then we, in 20 days, some of the most dangerous radioactive isotopes are no longer highly radioactive. They go through their half-life. They change into other materials. So closing it down immediately poses a great increase in the safety of people who live around the plant. But that's not all we have to do. We also have to store the irradiated fuel better, because right now it's kept in fuel pools, where you have all of this radioactive fuel in 3 pools in racks stored very closely together. What we need to do is take it out of this, where there's water circulating around to make sure the reaction doesn't get out of control. We need to move the materials into dry cask storage, which is steel concrete containers, which has, each one of them has less amount of radioactivity. They can be kept separately, so if somebody explodes one of them, it will not affect another. And it's a mechanical operation, so there's no cooling water. You can cut all the power, all the water at the plant, and it won't have any effect on these dry cask storage systems. So what do we need to do? We need to close that plant down, and we need to store the materials in a safer way. And this is not new unknown technology. Even Entergy has converted some of its irradiated fuel pools and other sites to dry cask storage, so it's completely feasible. I've got tons more to say, but you can ask me questions, and I'll talk about it then.
Now that Mark has scared us out of our wits, Marilyn is going to talk to us about how we should be frightened out of our wits about our purses. She's going to talk about the finances of Indian Point. Marilyn Ellis is the co-founder of Westchester Citizen Awareness Network. Marilyn.
Thank you. I think I need to get this a little closer. Maybe I will just hold it, actually. I want to take 2 seconds to do a little bit of housekeeping. Elizabeth, are there questions that people put up there? If you would just flip that down, I'll take a look at them. The other thing is, before people leave and get all fidgety and want to go home, I really want to remind you of the handouts that are right over there on the piano. They're in plastic envelopes. Everybody here can just help themselves. One important handout that I hope you will all leave with is this invitation to come up and join us at the plant. You will find when you get there, it's just right there at the Metro North train station in Peekskill. We will all be there. We'll be more than happy to welcome people from New York to really forge this coalition that is emerging from New York City all the way up to Albany. So please think about coming joining us. It's a lovely ride up the Hudson. You can meet people who are working to close the plant locally and people in the environmental groups who are part of the Indian Point Safe Energy Coalition. So I encourage you to take one of these. It's got directions on it. Give them to your friends. And
when?
Saturday. Saturday, February the 16th, we're meeting at noon. There's going to be a speak out. Today, I was at the plant, actually. The last time we had a demonstration at the plant was September. There's some pictures of what the entrance looks like. There was a union demonstration there today. About 250 workers were there saying how safe the plant was. Margot Shepard, a friend of mine, and I went, and somebody saw the signs we were holding that said decommissioning means jobs too, and they said, gee, there's only two of you, and look how many there is of us. There's about 250. So we looked at each other and said, well, those odds are about right. And they were, actually. We really do want to start a dialogue with the people in Buchanan, and I encourage you to think about that. That town lives off of Indian Point, and I'll get into a little bit more of that as I do finances. So you know about the handouts, you know about the 16th. I'm just going to mention this book. I'm not going to book talk it, but I want you to know about it, because if you're getting into energy, which is what I did, and everybody on this panel is doing, energy and radiation, you really may want to look at Seeing the Light, Regaining Control of Our Electricity System. Electricity started right here in New York. With Consolidated Edison, it wasn't consolidated then, but with Mr. Edison and a plant here in New York that served 84 homes. Very interesting. So this tells us where we came from and how we got here. I highly recommend the book. Okay, so much for housekeeping. Now, why is that plant still open? There is a one-word answer to that, and that word is money. And it works on many different levels. Here's what happens. And I first of all, let me say that this is something that I've been working on for the last 7 years. Activists fought to keep that plant out of the area. It was an amusement park. Activists for the last 20 years have fought to close it down, and they have not been successful because of money. Barbara Hickernell was the person that sort of stood in my shoes before. And I was very happy to let Barbara take care of Indian Point. I was busy with other things, and I know all of you are very busy with other things too. But what I discovered one day was that Barbara moved away, and nobody was watching Indian Point. So I was concerned about it because of the waste. I didn't know a lot about it, and I began to go to meetings and go to forums, and people called me Barbara for about 2 years. And finally, what happened was I began to understand a little bit more about the plant working and wanted to tell everybody. And every time I walked into a room, eyes would glaze over. Nobody wanted to hear about Indian Point. And nobody thought that it was a problem. And I kept trying to figure this out because to me it was so serious. And what I began to notice was pictures in the local paper. Consolidated Ed then would go to a town board meeting, and they'd have a check for $500. The check would be for benches in the park, or it would be for restoration of Steamboat Dock, which was a local project, or it would be for a special program in the school. Nobody's eyes glazed over when Con Ed walked in with those checks. I thought, oh, okay, I'll think about that. And then I started looking at the revenue from the plant. The plant does not pay taxes, but it does pay payments in lieu of taxes. They call it pilot. They made a deal with Buchanan when they moved in that they would pay them so much on a decreasing scale for hosting the plant. And Buchanan said, great, Nuclear power is safe. We know our energy is going to be too cheap to meter. We won't have to pay a lot of taxes. Come on up. And that's how the plant got in, under a lot of false premises of safety. And it's been there working on a decreasing amount of payments to the city of Buchanan. People in Buchanan are very worried. They're worried because their tax base is leaving them. It's eroding. And Con Ed actually filed for a reduction of the payments they were paying. And along about that time, Entergy came in. Well, to the people in Buchanan, the multinational corporation that has currently purchased this plant looks like a knight in shining armor. Because now they have people who willingly came in and said, yes, we will continue paying for your school system, we will continue paying for your library, and we will continue paying for your police and your fire system. And they really were happy to see Entergy come in. Well, what about the county? On the county level, it's about 3% of the local taxes. Not a lot, if you look at a $1.1 billion budget in Westchester, but still, it's money, and still, county executives look to that. Rockland gets no money, the county right across the river, gets no money from the plant. However, they do get $160,000 worth of emergency preparedness money for that department in their county. So Mr. Vanderhoff, who happens to be the county executive there, said, well, if I don't sign off on the evacuation plan, I don't get my money for my emergency preparedness department. $160 sounded like a lot of money. $160,000 sounded like a lot of money to him, so he signed off on it. So those are all the local implications of Indian Point and how it has become part of the fabric of the community. And with Entergy, it's really ratcheted up to a whole entire different level. We are now looking at why on earth would a multinational corporation choose to purchase a decrepit, falling apart, aging nuclear power plant? What's in it for them? And I was amazed to find out that there was a lot of long-term profit for this multinational corporation. Now, I have some handouts here. I'm going to ask the people who are doing handouts so nicely to pass these out. There are 70 handouts. I think we have about 69 people here. Okay. So please take one. And I'm sorry. Let me have one back. I just need one back.
Here, come out.
Thanks. Okay. Thanks. Just yes, please do. There's nothing wrong with limited liability holding companies. It's what many corporations do. Entergy has taken it to a whole new level, though. Each plant has its own limited liability holding company. What that means is if something happens, and you'll see when you get to the structure of that, if something happens at Indian Point 1, well, it's closed now, but if something happens at 2 or 3, the buck stops right there with that holding company. Limited liability holding companies are designed to keep risk down and let profits rise to the top. So if you look at this, if you look at this handout, what you'll see is a graph, and this is not the whole company by any means. This is just a snapshot of some of the limited liability holding companies that comprise Entergy Corporation. They have, for example, a limited liability holding company that has no assets. It does personnel. So whenever they need personnel, they've got their own, basically, you might say, in-house way to do that. So the money just gets shuffled around, shifted back and forth, and keeps the profits keep on going to the top. I will let you look at this, and I will be happy to take questions about it, because what I really want you to know is the profit from the decommissioning fund. When it, and people, ratepayers, paid money to the utility, to Consolidated Edison, and now to you, and now to Entergy as part of their bill for what is called a decommissioning fund. Everybody knows that nuclear power plants don't last forever. Nothing lasts forever. The licensing for Entergy will come up in 2012 for Indian Point 2. They've already said they want to relicense it and keep it going longer. So people have been paying into this decommissioning fund for a long time. Right now it is $500 million. What they paid for the plant was $625 million. So they're getting a rebate, a manufacturer's rebate. because that decommissioning fund is now listed on the books of Entergy Corporation as an asset. They can't go out and spend it. It's encumbered, but nonetheless, it's an asset. So it frees up an enormous amount of money. What can they do with this money? Well, they can use it as 5% collateral. Because they're a corporation, they can then go to the Federal Reserve. They can borrow money at 3%. Using that fund as 5% collateral. Pay the interest, keep it for 6 months, pay the interest, and they can end up on a short-term profit investment, they can end up with close to $1 billion. Now, of course, they have to pay back the loan, but their profit after paying the loan, $700 million, which is a really nice turnaround. And they can repeat the profit, they can repeat the process. It keeps going. I mean, whenever the market conditions warrant, they can do the whole thing all over again. So, the true cost of Indian Point 2? Zero. What is it? It's a cash cow for Entergy Corporation. And once the plant does have to be decommissioned, if there's anything left over, the money does not come back to the ratepayers. It goes to the stockholders because they own that huge fund, and it will keep on growing and growing through interest. They own that fund, and anything left over becomes profit for their stakeholders, for their stockholders. I'm going to stop right there. You have that. You can look at the details. You can take it away with you. You can think about it. And all I can say is, the money part is important, it's what keeps it going, but I think people power is even more important, and I think with a coalition of people that are in the city and in the suburbs and on up to Albany, we can really work together and close this plant down. Go to your community bureaus and your community boards, take the Riverkeeper resolution, and in the court of public opinion, we can win this, and it's a political fight, it's not a regulatory fight, this is a political fight. It's a political fight, and with enough people, we can shut that plant down. Thank you.
Thank you, Marilyn. Thank you so much for all the one more reason why we want to change the world. And the final one, well, final reasons we're going to hear from Joseph Mangano. He's the coordinator of the radiation. National Radiation Project, and he's going to talk to us about cancer and radiation.
Thank you. Our group is not an advocacy group like others represented here tonight, but really we are a bunch of health researchers. We are all trained in either medicine or physics or statistics or public health like I am, and our work is to do studies to look at the health effects of living near nuclear reactors. Now, my talk's going to be a little different tonight. A lot of the concern about nuclear power and its safety and health has to do with September 11th events and the possibility of an accident. At the end of my talk, I'm going to talk about accident just for about a minute, but for the most part, I will be talking about not the possibility of an accident, but the reality of what happens every day at a nuclear plant, and that is the releases of low-level emissions into the air and hence into the food chain. Okay, the reason our group even exists is this: we know that the emissions come out every day. No nuclear plant can operate under zero emissions. What's done about it, and how is health handled? Well, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission of the federal government has rules. They set what they call permissible limits, and they ask every company that runs a nuclear plant every year to report how much they emitted. The NRC takes a look at these reports and says, okay, your emissions are below our standards, therefore you can keep your license, you can keep running the reactor, and therefore the reactor is safe. There are no health hazards. Okay? We will do no studies to even look at it, and if studies are done, it's not because any cancer excesses are not because of reactor emissions, they're due to another reason. Now, not as a politician, but as a health professional, I have a great deal of problem with that. It's almost like saying we consider smoking 3 or 4 cigarettes or less every day to be within the permissible limits, okay? If you do that, you are safe, and we won't do any studies to see if they are unsafe. Well, that's very presumptive and may be hiding some deeper concerns. So our group formed in the mid-1980s of environmental pollutants, only because they're so small and because their systems are growing so rapidly. You damage a cell in an adult, and the cell replicates slowly. You damage a cell in a fetus, or in an infant or young child, it replicates very, very fast and thus causes more damage. Okay. Your basic question is, childhood cancer high in your nuclear plants? Well, we have a lot of studies from other countries, especially England, showing in most cases that they are high. Here in the United States, there have been no such studies. We've just submitted one for publication. We looked at 14 plants here in the East, including Indian Point, and we showed that at 14 out of 14 plants, the childhood cancer rate is higher than the national average. Okay, another target we pick on is breast cancer. Okay, has been known to be quite susceptible to the effects of radiation. My colleague Jay Gould wrote an entire book about breast cancer and found for the most part that in the counties near nuclear plants, the rates are high and they are rising much faster than the national rate. A third bit of research we did and are continuing to do looks at the issue, what happens to the health of local citizens when you close a nuclear power plant down? And we found that in 8 out of 8 reactors that closed since 1987, that created a 70-mile nuclear-free zone, in every one of those local areas, the infant death rates plummeted, the birth defect rates plummeted, the childhood cancer rates plummeted every single time. This is far more than a coincidence. It has what we call statistical significance, and we will be presenting more of this in the future. Now, specifically Indian Point, we have done some statistical studies on this area. We looked at the counties of Westchester and Rockland, because Indian Point sits right near Peekskill. It's on the Hudson River. On one side of the Hudson is Westchester, the other side is Rockland. Okay, we'll go back to the same categories. Is childhood cancer high in these counties? I see Karen has put up the correct chart already. In the last 12 years, the death rate from cancer to people under age 25, as children and adolescents, is 26% higher in Westchester and 30% higher in Rockland. Okay, now these really should be low-risk areas. Okay, we're not talking about the inner cities. We're not talking about people that lack access to health care and don't have health insurance and have no doctors and so forth. Okay, but yet they're still considerably higher. Also on that chart, I have bars for death rates for all other conditions. And they are high as well. Not as high as the cancer rates, but they exceed the national rate as well. And over 12 years, we're talking about 800 or so children here. And out of that, if a quarter or so are excess, we're talking several hundred children that died in excess. Okay, the next group I looked at, if you want to flip the chart around, thanks, is breast cancer. Okay, this is a chart that looks at Westchester and Rockland counties together, the last 12 years, the death rate from various diseases for people over 65, which account for the majority of deaths and breast cancer deaths. You'll see the first bar looks at breast cancer. The rate is 19% higher than the nation. And if you keep on going and looking at the other categories, most other diseases have low rates of death for the elderly. Heart disease, cardiovascular is slightly higher, but lung disease is lower. Digestive diseases are lower. Endocrine diseases, which includes things like diabetes, is lower. Again, we're talking about a low-risk area, okay? But still, breast cancer sticks out. And if anyone says, well, people are getting old, they have to die of something, I don't have a chart for it, but the same thing exists for people in their 40s and 50s who are not old, okay? Breast cancer higher, most diseases lower. Okay, these are just statistics. This is just the first cut. To do a better job of research, we have to do clinical studies, okay? Which, again, the government does not do. You ask any government official, how much radiation is in the bodies of people that live near nuclear plants? The answer is, I don't know, because they haven't taken any such measurements for 20 years. So a few years ago, my colleague Jay Gould got an idea to have what we call the Tooth Fairy Project. What we do is we ask for voluntary donations of baby teeth. Anyone wishing to do so can go to www.radiation.org or 1-800-582-3716. I have to get that in. And so far we've collected 3,400 teeth. What we do is we send them to a laboratory and the lab processes them and measures the amount of radioactive strontium-90. Strontium-90 is one of the 100 to 200 chemicals that is only found in nuclear reactors and in atomic bomb explosions. Strontium-90 is known to be one of the more damaging of these chemicals. Years ago, in the 50s and 60s, when the government was testing atomic bombs above the Nevada desert in these big mushroom clouds, people were quite concerned about fallout in general, but specifically strontium-90. Linus Pauling took a petition to the United Nations and singled out strontium-90. John Kennedy gave a speech appealing for the ban of all these above-ground tests, and he mentioned strontium-90. So this has been known to be a bad one. Again, we have 3,400 teeth so far. Basically, we found that the current levels of today's children are the same as they were back in the 1950s. There was a study done by some scientists in St. Louis that looked at the bomb fallout levels in the body. We also find levels are rising as the years go on, 10 to 20% over the last 10 years, which means there's a current source of emissions. And of course, we don't test bombs anymore. It can only be nuclear reactors. The third question, and this is the big one, is it harmful? We collected over 500 teeth from Suffolk County and Long Island. And we found that in the periods when strontium-90 went up, the childhood cancer rates went up. Periods where strontium-90 went down, the childhood cancer rates went down, almost an exact match. We found a link, and we published this in a journal a year ago. Now, we have brought the baby tooth study to Westchester because of great concern of citizens about Indian Point. Just over a year ago, the legislature invited us to testify in front of their health committee, and we brought Alec Baldwin, who kindly consented to give his day up, and we asked them for funding to run a large-scale baby tooth study. And sure enough, the legislature enacted such a law and appropriated $25,000. I'm sorry to say that the Westchester Health Department held up the contract for almost a year. However, we do have a contract now, and we're beginning to collect and test teeth. We have 65 so far, and we are expecting another 300, in which case we can do a full analysis like we did in Long Island. The map you see over here is a simple tooth-by-tooth description of the first 65 teeth from Westchester and 20 from Putnam County. The dots represent varying levels of strontium-90. The red dots are the bad ones, are the really, really high ones, okay? Levels that we haven't seen since the days of above-ground atomic bomb testing in the 50s and 60s. There appears to be more of a cluster of them in the Peekskill area, right near the nuclear power plant. But again, we're going to do a much better job of this by the end of the year and collect many more teeth and have many more dots up there. The best thing we can do is to look at, for example, children with cancer, test the strontium in their body versus the healthy children living in the same area. We're starting to do that. Too few teeth so far, but so far we do see that kids with cancer have higher levels. One more study, I can't speak ever without mentioning this, is that, as I mentioned, years ago in St. Louis, there was a study of baby teeth done. In an amazing display, this group of scientists collected 300,000 teeth over a 12-year period, showed this extremely fast increase in the buildup of strontium in the body and a decrease after the test ban treaty was signed. Last June, I got a call from officials out there saying, we found 85,000 of the teeth. Apparently, they were not used. Okay, the donors are baby boomers. They are people mostly in their 40s. So we are, after funding now, we're going to do a follow-up health study. We're going to locate these people. We're going to do a health questionnaire on them. Have you ever had cancer or asthma or pneumonia or thyroid disease? And we're going to test teeth, and we're going to find the answer to the question, is having high strontium, high radiation in your body, predispose you to higher levels of cancer and higher levels of other diseases, which we think is going to be a great asset to our work. Now for my one-minute spiel on an accident. And it's only worth one minute because it's any accident like this would eclipse by far, and Mark has talked about this already, the disaster of September 11th. It wouldn't even be close. First of all, this issue, from a health perspective, this issue of evacuating only a 10-mile radius is a joke, quite frankly. Say there was an accident, a terrorist hit the reactor. High levels of radiation would immediately spew out into the air and be moved through the prevailing winds. How fast do winds blow? 5 and 10 miles an hour. Well, within an hour, it's going to reach that 10-mile limit. In another hour, it's going to go another 10 miles and keep going and going and going. Okay? I don't care how fast one evacuates, many people are going to breathe in large amounts of this. Point two, even once the radioactive plume dissipates, okay, and people want to go back and live in the area, that's also a joke. Because what happens to the radiation afterwards? It flies around through the it flies around through the air until it is brought back to Earth in precipitation, meaning it gets in the reservoir, in the drinking water. It gets into the pastures, so the cows graze on them and give contaminated milk. It gets into vegetables and meat and so on. So even after the plume is gone, we will be eating and drinking contaminated food and water. And this is exactly what's going on in Chernobyl now, 16 years after the accident. Chernobyl is kind of like North Dakota. It's the breadbasket of the former Soviet Union. It produces lots of wheat. Well, where does the wheat grow in the soil? What's in that soil? Lots of strontium-90 and cesium-137 and so on and so forth. The third health issue, and last I'll mention about an accident, is there's been a lot of talk about this potassium iodide, these tablets that one can take to block the uptake of radioactive iodine to the thyroid gland. And yes, that's what it does. It does prevent thyroid disease. However, it's almost like saying you have a dike with 100 holes and you're plugging one. It doesn't do anything about strontium. It doesn't do anything about cesium or plutonium or uranium and barium and on and on and on. So yes, while it may protect the thyroid gland, its benefits would be minimal. As Mark told you before, the casualties of this would be incredible. I forget what he said. 50,000 deaths immediately in the local area, and that's just a very, very minimal estimate. So in closing, we certainly hope that not just accidents are discussed with Indian Point. We hope that the health effects, the actual health effects, the actual numbers of sick and dead bodies that are being produced, possibly by the emissions for this reactor, become a part of nuclear policy and our government policy so that we can avoid the hazards of the past. Thank you very much.
And we want to change this. But in the meantime, five of these plants that somebody mentioned, I think it was Alex, we're trying to stop them from being built, five new ones. Now, we have whole different sets of sicknesses and illnesses. The place is called Alice Mahaly for very good reasons. So, we want to see this shut down. We don't want to see any more fossil fuels. And I thought River Keeper was fighting the fossil fuel plants. I don't quite understand it. So what's the alternative?
Well, I'd like to respond to that. I didn't mention it in my earlier talk, but this is out there, Sustainable Energy Briefing Paper. We sent this to every member of Congress, and we've heard from Congressman Bob Thune in California. He's drafting a Dear Colleague letter. They're going to have a discussion about passing a National Sustainable Energy Act. And it's here. This explains. The technology is here. Everything is here. It's the political will. It's campaign finance reform. It's like, you know, stopping these terrible interests, you know, that are promoting nuclear and fossil fuels. So we should get behind that.
There are also a few different other pieces to this. First of all, solar and wind power are much cleaner technology, pieces of technology, areas of technology, power generation. But for years, it troubled me when people brought that up. And the reason is, since I was a kid, people have been talking about wind and solar, and it kept coming in my mind, why do they keep talking about it? If it was viable, wouldn't we have wind and solar right now? Well, finally, I think I understand the answer. Here's the answer, in my view. But the study is not for my view only. Since 1947, the federal government has spent approximately $150 billion from 1947 on solar, wind, and nuclear power. 96.3% of that money went to nuclear power. If we had invested similarly in solar or similarly in wind, we would have it right now. But now I want to get to your question in particular, was more specific. Those plants that Alex is talking about are not New York City plants. The power that's coming from Indian Point into Manhattan is very limited. And if it were to be closed down, Indian Point were to be closed down, you're still going to be able to get enough power from outside the city into the city. New York City's power needs are not limited by power coming into New York City from outside. The limits on New York City's power needs are that New York City is supposed to, according to the Public Service Commission, provide 80% of the power within the boroughs. That's the problem. Closing Indian Point down, you're still going to get the same amount of power coming in from outside. It's going to be able to be shifted from another place on the grid. And those power plants that he's talking about are predominantly mixed-use or natural gas plants, and they're coming online up and down the Hudson River Valley and upstate. That they're not the ones online in New York City. So I don't think there's any conflict between the efforts to stop the building of more in Asthma Alley and more greenhouse gas producing plants in the New York City area with our efforts. I think we work very much together because we support the use of sustainable energy sources and, in addition, the implementation of demand-side management programs, which is a fancy way of saying conservation. California was able to save 12% in the peak month of August last year. After all the problems, the blackouts, the brownouts, they went through a massive conservation program, and the result was 12% savings. Well, Indian Point produces 6-7% of the power in New York State. 12% savings. We're not good in New York State. We have very limited demand-side management programs. We could certainly implement something similar to what they did there. There are lots of pieces to that.
United States right now. I live directly across the street from the new bus barn, House 137, double diesel buses. Those huge air vents are merely feet from my house. Why I bring this up to you tonight is I plan to pitch this at our community board. And I would like to ask and remind everybody, well, I guess one word came up to me while I was new, and that was the WEF this weekend. I was there, and I am listening to everybody, and I want you to know that as I listen to you, this is a little symptom of a huge problem, and that the way our system works doesn't work. But what I find out when I get involved in community groups, I'm willing to come and pitch for you in Westchester. But what I want to know, are you willing to come and pitch with me in East Harlem? Because this is what I find out happens, is that very few people reciprocate, and this movement can't work unless we understand that community organizing has to reciprocate with one another. Right. One question I just have for the money lady. And I'd rather be alive than have a lot of money, thank you. But I just wanted to ask you, as you were talking about this group, and this is way confusing for me, but the word Enron kept going through my mind, and all I want to know is, are we looking, the Enrons are like octopuses all of a sudden, I guess Enron's the first one, but wouldn't you say that this sounds very close to what we have with Enron?
I wouldn't say, I'm not in no position to make the comparisons, but I will say that last spring, when Citizens Awareness Network went to the NRC's adjudication process to try to stop the license transfer, one point that we made up was that we kept bringing up was that this company does not have enough resources on tap if all these plants should go down. The NRC is looking at a best case scenario so that they've got the energy going on, that everything works. If Indian Point 2 goes down, if Indian Point 3 goes down, if Fitzpatrick goes down, they don't have enough of a reserve. So we were very concerned then about the cash reserve they brought to this deal. The NRC hadn't really thought about that a whole bunch. They did look at it. They did just delay the license transfer, and then they did go ahead and approve it. So all I can tell you is it's shaky. This whole corporate structure is very shaky, and certainly that's a similarity and a parallel. And it's really tough to figure out and to look at these finances, but I really appreciate what you're saying about WEF and the corporate structure, because all of the corporations there work in a very similar way. And that's what we're looking at here, locally, and I'm thinking here we can do something about it.
You know, on
that.
Have
a question over here?
I don't, but I just want to add that U.S. News & World Reports on Monday, September 10, came out with an article, kind of eerie now to think about it, on the vulnerability of nuclear plants to terrorist attacks. Okay, they talked about, if you ever want to go to the library, I carry one with me at all most times. U.S. News & World Report. It's a September 17 issue, but it hit the stands Monday, September 10. And it went into great detail about how many, the government, NRC, tested these nuclear plants for preparedness for an attack and how most of them flunked and how the NRC didn't do anything about it. Okay, so people knew long before. The NRC knew, not just this fellow. But
point, or anti-aircraft, or putting those hard they don't care about us. That's what it is. I mean, there's not the x-ray machines in the airport, and they have Star Wars going on. So I have a Star Wars action alert here. It's all connected.
Yes, it is.
These corporate drivers. I mean, the Congress's board, the President's board, and they're driving this forward, and people...
Okay, go.
I've got two questions. One is about the nuclear waste fund that you mentioned, Marilyn. If the company gets to keep whatever's left over, what does that mean in terms of the standards of how well they actually clean up an accident? God forbid it happens. That's number one question. The second question is about these new pebble bed modular reactors, mm-hmm. which have no containment dome whatsoever. Yet they're being billed as, these plants can't possibly melt down. So if I'd like you to comment on that.
Sure. The decommissioning fund is not for accidents. That's when the plant is taken offline. Yeah. And if you get to keep all the money that's left over, what you want to do is you want to do quick and dirty decommissioning. Maybe you don't take it down to a green field, you take it down to a brown field. There are all kinds of different standards that come into play, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has been notoriously lax in supervising what happens when a plant is decommissioned. So it's a real worry. And in regard to the pebble bed reactors, they are not safe. They do not have containment, and it's just a ploy on the part of the industry to bring in really what is not a new technology at all, but something that has tried and failed 20 years ago. Instead of having rods, you have, they call them pebbles, they're about this big, and there's a whole continuing rotation. They get stuck in the process, they've had problems with them, and they're not good.
There is a model for a much safer nuclear reactor. I'm certainly not in support of using that as opposed to using clean sources of energy. I don't think we should have any nuclear reactors. But the reason I bring this up, it's called the PIUS reactor, P-I-U-S, all capital letters. They're not looking into that. And the reason they're not looking into it is because it's too expensive to build. So, I mean, if you were to have a reactor which would be more safe, still not safe enough, but more safe in terms of its operation, and more safe in terms of its security, they're not really willing to look into that because of the cost involved. That's been around since the 1980s. I mean, that's nothing new.
And how cheap the sun is.
That's a nuclear reactor we need.
That's the only good nuclear reactor.
That's right.
Yeah, a few of us here are from Long Island, where we're under several radii, Millstone as well. Are there charts that we could access with regard to be similar to this, and also maybe for Millstone, because we're starting a series of forums there.
Sure. STAR, Standing for Truth About Radiation, on their website, they're very much addressed with Millstone, and they have a lawsuit going against them because they're missing two of their spent fuel. That's another euphemism, spent fuel rods. I mean, it's hotter than when it goes in. It's not spent at all. It's hot, radiated. And basically, as New Yorkers, we're in a triple zone here. We have Oyster Creek in New Jersey. We have Millstone in Connecticut. We have Indian Point, up the river. We're like in this triple axis of evil. So we want to shut down Indian Point, but I think we really want to shut them all down. Let's start with Indian Point because we're on a roll, and you know, we've got like energy moving on it, but let us not forget all over the country, you know, and particularly even in our own zone. And we can be an inspiration to other people that we actually shut one down.
Can and will.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Who was the
third person?
You are.
I came down from Westchester to be here tonight to talk to people. I don't really have a question. I keep showing up at events and not talking to the people that are taking questions, but to the audience themselves. I went out, and after I first saw Mark Jacobs talk, I went home that night and was a little frustrated that I could get the one flyer from their website, but I couldn't really get something like this. So I'm sure there's something like this tonight. I went home and printed this out myself, wrote it myself, printed it out, and handed out 1,000 copies to people on the street. I really Nobody's for nuclear power, but people won't take one. It's like, oh no, I'm not for nuclear power. I'm against it. I'm with you. They won't take it. But you'd be amazed if they read this. They go, oh, I didn't realize we don't need the power. I didn't realize there's 20 million people. I didn't realize Indian Point was so close. It's amazing the gaps in the knowledge out there.
Yes.
I want everybody to really go out there. If you could just make 10, if you just afford to do 10, do 10. If you do 20, do 20. Everybody you give it to, tell them to do the same thing. I'm willing to give anybody, I mean, you don't need these because they're all here tonight. But if anybody wants this, you can get it from my website and download it. This is just the same information that you heard Mark Jacobs say here tonight. I live 10.5 miles from the plant. I'm directly in the flights over Westchester Airport. I'll say Sunday night around 8 o'clock, the planes, that's my wife calling, start flying over my house. So the house is shaking. They come every 40 seconds for 3 solid hours every Sunday night. Give you some idea what we're up against. Not only that, I started a letter writing campaign.
Thank you.
I'm Elizabeth Shanklin, and I'm a member of the Green Party. I live in the Bronx. And 25 miles from Indian Point. And about 6 weeks or 2 months ago, about our vulnerability. And we have been working in coalition with the South Bronx Clean Air Coalition. Francis Sturm is here. Now, Francis Sturm closed down. She was one of the triumvirate that really worked for how many years, Francis?
10 years.
And they closed down a medical incinerator in the South Bronx. And we're working with Mr. David Grant, who's working there. This is the... David is the chair of the CARAT team of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. And the CARAT team is Community Action Response Against Toxics. So we have started working. Ann Egan is here. Where is she? There's Ann Egan. Ann Egan has held a forum in Queens. And we held a forum in the Bronx. So this is the third forum in New York City. We decided that the Riverkeeper Resolution, at that time it had passed maybe 12 or 13 villages, that this was an excellent strategy to take the Riverkeeper Resolution to the 59 community boards of New York City. Now, I had experience doing that because I was the citywide coordinator of a pesticide resolution campaign, and 54 of the 59 community boards endorsed our resolution, including 3 borough boards. That was a resolution to stop the spraying. The community boards are the agency of city government set up for local people to bring their concerns. Now, they are appointed, of course. We in the Green Party, at least the ones I know, think that we ought to be electing people to the community boards because they're not really accountable to us, but they will pay attention to us, especially if we approach them in a systematic, impressive way. Well, we're working in coalition, of course, with all the wonderful people who are here, and we're really the child of Westchester Citizens Awareness Network, because we couldn't have held a forum if their members hadn't come and spoken. And perhaps some of you here tonight are here because some of us contacted you because you had signed a petition on the Westchester website. Now, we have now amassed a database of people who have signed the petition in Westchester, and on our own, we have our own baby website, www.nyc, Close Indian Point, and people are signing there. So we're taking those names, and we know that those people care a great deal. They look into the websites and sign this, and when we were calling them for this meeting, the people were amazingly creative. What we want to do is all over the city, since we have this database, I can pick out 6, 10, 15, 20 people who live in one community board district. If you will initiate with me, I will help you and the other members who have a little bit more experience with this. If you will initiate going to your community board, we will bring support. Joe Mangano has volunteered because most of us go to the health committee of the community boards, and Joe has experience with community boards and he's very concerned about this, and other people. I was speaking to Alice. I think she's going to go with us too as an expert. I'm not an expert, but I am an advocate and I'm pretty well organized. Did it this morning, as a matter of fact. I faxed to the health committee of a community board 12 in Manhattan, because when I called yesterday to this person I'd never met, she said, go ahead and send the letter for me because I'm ready to go to my community board. Now, we will go with you. What do we send? I want you to understand that, because if you, it's my experience, if you do it the right way, you will be taken seriously. And what does that mean? You don't let them blow you off, because if you call up your community board and say, I want to speak about this topic, they'll say, oh, good, come to the next community board meeting and you have 3 minutes. Well, that is nowhere, because they don't even have to address whatever you say in those 3 minutes. But if you apply to be put on the agenda of a specific committee, then you go in, and we will go in with you. You're on the agenda. They sit and they hear you. You say you're here. The letter says, you've got it in your packet, I'm coming on behalf of this resolution. And so you will present the resolution. If you are prepared to speak in detail about it, all the better. If you need support, experts, fine. I will come and speak about all over the city, people are doing it, and, you know. We will bring also all the people on our database who care about this to come and support. Once the committee thinks it's a good idea, then they present it to the community board. And the community board doesn't dismiss its own committee the way they will dismiss us just talking for 3 minutes. So you're on the agenda again, because the committee puts you on the agenda of the community board. Then, again, we come out in force, and we come out with people who can speak very cogently. We can't always get Mark Jacobs. I saw Mark Jacobs at 6:15 this morning. It was unbelievable. Anyway, all right. 6:15 on Fox 5. All right. That's the plan for community boards. Julia Willebrand was for 10 years president of Toastmasters that met at the American Bar Association. If you don't know what Toastmasters is, I can't really say exactly what it is either, but it's an organization that enables you to learn how to make public speeches. She is a super expert, and she is holding a practice session tomorrow night for us to practice going to community boards. And so I want to distribute to you now our calendar, because we have a calendar of events. Would you just take that? And you'll see the address there of where we're meeting. It's on it's St. Anne's Church, St. Mary's Church.
It's St. Mary's Church, and for those of you that live in New York City, it's a treat. It happens to be the oldest operating church in Harlem. It's been there since 1823. And it's amazing, this little church with a church yard and a church house and whatever. And it's just, I love to find those things in New York City. So come tomorrow night if you want to see something really quite extraordinary in the industrial area of Harlem. What?
What's the address?
It's St. Mary's Episcopal Church. It's on West 126th Street between Old Broadway and Amsterdam. On the 1 of the 9 train, get off at 125th Street and you just walk up to 126th to turn the corner and you'll find it there, and it's quite amazing. You go in a green door in a little yellow house. Whatever that 1823 house is doing there, I don't know, but I think it's wonderful. So come.
What time?
6:30.
Okay, so this is our community board campaign. Now, when we go to a community board, this is a public event. We can send out press releases about this, that we're going. We can send out press releases about the result of it, and we get attention in this way. The committee, the health committee, has passed this resolution that 25 municipalities have passed. So we build awareness in the community, and we're fully prepared to do that. So we want to coordinate this as well. We have a website, and Joel Myers is not here tonight, the Webster, but he has set up. Yeah, he's great. And so we're going to keep and build momentum by recording there so everyone can see where the next meeting is. You can go to the website and you can see we're presenting next week. Estelle Epstein here got us on the agenda for the health committee in Brooklyn. So we'll be presenting there, and you are welcome to come to this presentation. Joe is going to be speaking, as will Estelle and I. And anyone else who is interested in speaking, great, but come for support too, okay? So we're going to keep building momentum by keeping that up on our website. You can always go to it and see who's making a presentation and where and how it's advancing. We did this in the pesticide campaign, and it built a lot of momentum for this. Now, we are hoping to get this really going, and we have coordinators in each borough. And Ivana Edwards is the coordinator for Manhattan. Ivana, would you just, that's Ivana. And and Jerry Kahn in Queens. Jerry? And we have a coordinator in Staten Island. Anyone is here from Staten Island? Yeah, we don't have too many people in our database from Staten Island, too, but we have a wonderful coordinator. And we have a wonderful coordinator in Brooklyn. He's not here tonight either, Rudolph Ruffin from CBTU. So, and the Bronx, I'm in the Bronx, right, of this campaign, because that's only one aspect of our campaign, and it is to go to the council members. And Ivana yesterday was highly successful. Ivana, would you like to tell us about, would you like to come up and use the mic?
Yes.
Yeah, please. She has a wonderful letter from go ahead.
Many of you who live on the east side will probably know that Liz Krueger is running for the state senate. The election is next Tuesday, and she's issued a statement on this issue, and I will read it to you. As a candidate for the state senate on the east side of New York, I feel it is my duty to look after the well-being of my potential constituents with regards to any issue that may affect them. Furthermore, if I find a situation that stands to cause egregious harm, it is my duty to speak out, act out, and do whatever is necessary to solve that situation, no matter what the cost to me. To be frank, my job is to do what is right for the people I seek to serve. The two operating plants at Indian Point and the 600 tons of radioactive waste stored there can easily be targeted by land, air, and water. I am deeply concerned about the vulnerability of the metropolitan area to a terrorist attack on Indian Point, which is 24 miles upstream from New York City. 20 million people live within a 50-mile radius of the plants, and New York City's drinking water supply is within that radius. Additionally, the evacuation plans for the 10-mile radius around the plants are outdated and ineffective. Therefore, I believe that New York State should begin the process of decommissioning Indian Point. We should also explore more efficient and safer energy sources with which to supply the electric needs of New York City. Just as importantly, we must refocus the state's energy policy away from reliance on nuclear and fossil fuel technology and toward expansion of renewable energy sources, alternative technologies, and reduction of energy usage through conservation. New York should implement standards that assure a certain portion of the electricity sold on the wholesale market is from new, clean, and renewable energy sources. Every community and every community board is absolutely unique and different. However, the power of this resolution lies in the fact that if we can all pass the same resolution and we're all standing behind it, it will really mean a lot. People have made the point that this resolution does not carry the force of law, and it's true. However, if we all pass the same petition, it's a lot of people standing behind it, and it gives us a lot of power. It's very tempting to say, well, I'm just going to change this a little bit here, or I'm going to make a little change over there, and maybe you will need to do that. You know your own situations. I don't. However, I really strongly encourage you to try to use this one petition so that we can all stand united behind it and not take a bunch of people out and say, well, they passed it except for, or this is a little different over here because of. So really, really, if we can all work on from the same piece of paper, we'll be a lot more powerful.